BBC World Service, this is Alex Brody with NewsHour. Coming up, having acknowledged doubts about the war, the Americans' staunchest ally, Tony Blair, goes to the Middle East to reassure, to justify, and to plead for calm. To Saudi Arabia, to the Gaza Strip, and to Syria, the first British Prime Minister in Damascus. We hear what the Syrians told him. We also hear from the American businessman who was backing the late Afghan commander Abdul Haq and who tried to save him. Also, differences among American Muslims over the bombing as reports come in of the first strong attacks on Taliban front lines. And from Panama, a 500-year-old shipwreck. Was it Christopher Columbus's? First, we bring you the main world news in detail.
BBC News, I'm John Ovenden. On what's been described as a day of difficult diplomacy, the British Prime Minister Tony Blair has met the Syrian and Saudi Arabian leaders at the start of a tour of the Middle East. In Damascus, President Bashar al-Assad of Syria said he supported international action against terrorism, but the word terrorist should not be used to describe groups fighting against Israel for Palestinian rights. Mr. Blair then went on to Saudi Arabia, where he held talks with King Fahd. Our political editor, Andrew Marr, who's travelling with the Prime Minister, sent us this assessment of the day.
Neither Syria nor Saudi Arabia are easy countries for a Western leader to visit at this particular time. Syria remains very high on the United States list of states who sponsor terrorism, while Saudi Arabia is in an extremely jumpy mood. It was here, after all, that Osama bin Laden originated, and many members of the Saudi royal family were active supporters of him until relatively recently. The Prime Minister had to endure a lengthy and at times aggressive denunciation of the Western war against terrorism in Afghanistan. President Assad said he deplored the killing of so many, indeed hundreds, of innocent Afghan civilians. Nevertheless, Mr. Blair feels that he has built important bridges and has done a little bit of the spadework that's going to be necessary if the peace process is to be restarted. Britain and America now accept that that is utterly essential if the coalition on terrorism is to be accepted.
Violence has continued in the West Bank, where Israeli forces have killed six Palestinians, including a top Hamas commander in the town of Hebron. Reports say Jamil Jalala was hiding in a barn when he was hit by a single Israeli missile. The Israelis say he was planning to carry out attacks inside Israel. The Palestinian leader, Yasser Arafat, said the continued violence was completely at odds with what had been agreed with Israel, and that dialogue had to resume. A fourth person has died from anthrax in the United States. The victim, Kathy Nguyen, has been critically ill since Sunday with the inhaled form of the disease, the most deadly strain. The source of her infection has so far remained a mystery. She worked in the basement stockroom of a New York hospital, which was combined with a mail sorting room. Jane Stanley reports from New York.
The woman died 3 days after checking herself into Manhattan's Lenox Hill Hospital, where she was diagnosed as suffering from the first New York case of the more serious respiratory form of anthrax. The woman, who was 61, lived alone in the Bronx. Her route to work on the New York City subway is being checked by investigators, and her social life is being reconstructed in an effort to find the source of her infection. A spokesman for the United States President, George Bush, expressed condolences to the woman's family on behalf of the president and described her death as an event of concern.
You're listening to the news from the BBC in London. As new figures confirm that the American economy shrank in the third quarter of this year, the World Bank has warned that the world is slipping towards a recession. In the United States, economic output fell 0.4%, the first decline for 8 years, although it was not as sharp as some economists had forecast. Here's Stephen Evans.
The World Bank says the attacks in the United States on September the 11th have unleashed what it calls new and unpredictable forces that have substantially raised the risk of a global downturn. Accordingly, it's revised down its forecast for global growth to just over 1% this year, compared with nearly 4% in the year 2000. Growth in the poorer countries is expected to fall to 3% this year, compared with more than 5% last year. Latin America, East Asia, and Africa south of the Sahara would be particularly hard hit. Much turns on whether growth picks up in the United States, Japan, and Europe, all facing a sharp slowdown. The bank thinks recovery is likely, but far from certain.
The United States Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld is to travel to Russia and some of Afghanistan's Central Asian neighbors this weekend to discuss the progress of the campaign against Afghanistan. The trip comes after more than 3 weeks of bombing have failed to produce significant movement in the front lines in Afghanistan. In the latest attacks, U.S. planes have carried out a heavy bombing raid on Taliban positions north of the Afghan capital, Kabul. Afghanistan's Taliban foreign minister, Wakil Ahmed Mutawakil, has dismissed reports of rifts in the Taliban. At a news conference in the Taliban stronghold of Kandahar, Mr. Mutawakil denied reports that he'd secretly visited Pakistan in an effort to open talks with the United States. He said Pakistan's support for the United States would have bad consequences. Earlier, Taliban representatives said 1,500 people had been killed since the bombing raid started 3 weeks ago. However, there's no independent confirmation of this figure. BBC World Service News.
You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Brodie. This is NewsHour. The British Prime Minister Tony Blair yesterday publicly acknowledged increasing doubts about the American attacks in Afghanistan and then set off on another of his diplomatic missions to try to stiffen support for the operation and keep the potentially dangerous Palestinian-Israeli conflict quiet. And he plunged into the heart of the Middle East, to Syria, to Saudi Arabia, and he's going on to the Gaza Strip to meet the Palestinian leader, Yasser Arafat. In Saudi Arabia a short time ago, Mr. Blair was meeting both King Fahad and Crown Prince Abdullah. His job? To reassure and justify the bombing campaign. Mr. Blair acknowledged differences in opinion between the West and some Arab states.
Well, I think we have to understand that there are different perspectives that people will bring to this situation. But, you know, you can either stay out of the dialogue or get into it and try and build a bridge of understanding for the future. Now, in the end, in respect of the Middle East peace process, this is only going to work if people negotiate and discuss rather than use violence to get their way.
Earlier in Syria, Mr. Blair clearly sought to try to influence President Bashar al-Assad to use his influence on radical Palestinian groups to calm the conflict with Israel. President Assad's message was basically that old saw about one man's terrorist being another man's freedom fighter. Palestinians, he said, have a right to resist Israeli occupation.
I personally drew a difference between resistance and terrorism and between Islam and terrorism, and it is a big difference. Resistance is a social right, it's a religious right, it's a legal right, and a right guaranteed by United Nations resolutions.
The words of President Bashar al-Assad of Syria. Syria is still on the Americans' blacklist of states who sponsor terrorism, which raises some awkward questions for the US. How should America handle a relationship with a government it disapproves of, but which circumstances dictate it cultivates? U.S. Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz.
I think it's pretty clear that what you want from Syria or any other country is maximum cooperation going after the terrorists and getting out of the business of supporting terrorists. And until you get to those endpoints, it's hard to say. I mean, in certain countries, and Syria is clearly on that list, have a lot more to do to clean up their record than others. I think it was a British prime minister who said about 60 years ago that if Herr Hitler invaded hell, I would find a way to say a good word about the devil himself. That was Churchill talking about cooperating with the Soviet Union during World War II. I don't think he in any way compromised his abhorrence at communism.
The American Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz. Syria's Minister of Information is Adnan Imran. I asked him what he'd made of Tony Blair's visit and what message President Assad had given him.
I believe it was a very positive visit. It was a chance for exchange of views with total frankness. Mr. Blair presented his points of views and also listened to President Assad. Syria stressed very strongly its condemnation for terrorism in all its forms and its readiness to work hard in order to combat terrorism through the mechanism of the United Nations, defining terrorism in order not to make mistakes, and then afterward the mechanism with the United States within the framework of the UN, then this would be the method which will be much safer in order to combat terrorism.
But does Syria approve of the American bombing of Afghanistan?
No, Syria made its views very clear. We said that war, which will result in killing many innocent civilians, will not solve terrorism. It is the only solution is to join efforts within the framework of the United Nations, as I said, and work hard using every effort possible in order to bring to uproot terrorism in every way.
Mr. Blair clearly or would have sought to ask Syria to use its influence on radical Palestinian groups like the PFLP, which have long been hosted in Damascus. Did he ask that, and what was the response?
No, there was discussion on the situation, but of course our views are quite very known. When you say radical Palestinians, you are referring exactly to the liberation, the resistance movement which you had in Europe at a certain time during the Second World War. We all know and remember that General de Gaulle himself was a leader of one of these movements. He was headquartered in London. London was the headquarters, in fact, of most of the leaders of those who were fighting occupation in Europe. And I don't believe that it's helpful to mix that very naively a terrorist whom we all condemn and should be, of course, combated, and a fighter for freedom. Nelson Mandela, according to this definition, would not be except a terrorist.
I take
George Washington, in fact, would be a terrorist if we consider his uprising against the British as a terrorist action.
I take your point that the mood, the tone between the two men would have been warm. They're both civilized men. But I find it difficult to detect anything that they agree on.
No, they agreed on many, many points. The need to exert all efforts in order to bring permanent, lasting peace in the Middle East based on United Nations resolutions. And that will, of course, when peace is prevailing, that will be a great step in order to eliminate the roots, because they talked not only about terrorism, but also about the reasons why terrorism is growing here and there. It is because of the deep dissatisfaction, the total violation of UN Charter and UN resolutions. This is what was one of the subjects which they spoke about.
And that was Syria's Minister of Information, Adnan Imran. I discussed this all further with two Arab journalists, Maher Otman of the Pan-Arab newspaper Al-Hayat here in London, and in Saudi Arabia, the editor-in-chief of the Arab News, Khalid El-Mayin. Maher Otman first. Could he see anything President Assad and Tony Blair did agree on?
I honestly cannot see much that they could agree between them. They looked during the press conference as if they were talking at each other rather than with each other. I mean, Mr. Blair spoke about the necessity of dialogue, but I don't think they got much mileage out of that dialogue today. The differences are absolutely basic. And one of them is how Britain, for example, and the West regard the Palestinian groups that are based in Washington, and the other was that...
Based in Damascus.
In Damascus. And the other was, of course, Blair is now calling for the implementation of the Mitchell plan prior to the resumption of negotiations. And Syria has always expressed fears that this Mitchell plan might become a replacement for the basis of peace in the Middle East.
As the Oslo Accord did, Syria never joined.
Exactly. And then, you know, obviously, President Assad must have welcomed what Mr. Blair and Mr. Bush said about a possible Palestinian state in the future. But then he at the same time sees, like many, many Arab leaders and ordinary Arabs, that not much happens on the ground. Nobody is putting pressure on the government of Sharon to withdraw his forces and dismantle the settlements.
Quick one on that. Do the Syrians see Tony Blair as merely an outrider for George Bush, or do they see him as a European? And the Europeans have traditionally been closer to the Palestinians than the Americans. Do they think that through Blair they can exert some pressure on Bush to be tough on Sharon?
I think they see him as a man who speaks for the United States, because he was the first one to join this war besides America. And I don't think his role could be distinguished from the American role. They see the Europeans in a different light.
Let's go to Saudi. Khalid Al-Mayina. Did Mr. Blair get a rough ride in Saudi Arabia?
Well, the Saudis by nature are very hospitable, so I don't think so. Even if things behind the scene were a little bit rough. Mr. Blair has just left, but I think the main focus of attention here, apart from Mr. Blair trying to enlist support for his campaign and Mr. Bush's campaign, was whether Saudis focused on the present situation in the occupied Palestinian lands and the importance of trying to arrive at a solution, a just solution.
Was that top of the Saudi agenda?
Well, we don't know exactly what was there because Mr. Blair just left, but I think sources do say that the Saudis have been very vocal in that field, and as you know, we have been focusing on that issue for quite some time.
But on the substantive matter of the bombing of Afghanistan, what message would Mr. Blair have got from Saudi Arabia?
Well, the message would be that people are concerned, people are cautious, people are anxious about what's going on. And as long as people in this part of the world view and see on television and read and hear about innocent people being killed, I think that support, whatever support, even the governments in the area that have provided, even though it's a limited one in the eyes of the West, would at a later stage erode. And with Ramadan coming now, Muslims would find it very difficult to bear their brethren, I mean, innocent people. I'm not talking about the Taliban itself, but about the millions of refugees who are now going to suffer a harsh winter.
Do you believe that Mr. Blair has achieved anything in Saudi Arabia?
I don't think so, Mr. Blair. These are, whistle-stop tours, as the Americans say. I don't think so. I mean, you need to have long negotiations, protracted. I mean, a thing that's also bugging people is the attack on Muslim organizations, humanitarian organizations. So I don't think so these 1 hour or 2 hour visits are going to solve any. They need a lot of groundwork, foreign ministers or other bureaucrats coming in. So I don't think so much has been achieved throughout the tour.
Maher Rotman, do you think he's actually achieving anything?
I agree with Mr. Maina that really to achieve something, the dialogue must go deeper and over a longer span of time, and the differences are so wide they cannot be bridged in such a short time.
What's happening though here? I mean, Mr. Blair is being assiduous in his diplomacy, either on his own part or on the part of George Bush. Is this a sort of a Blair learning curve? Is this Mr. Blair trying to put flesh on the bones of his speeches about changing the world order? How do you see this in the Arab world?
Well, the new world order is supposed to be a just one, but it has been dominated by the United States, which keeps supporting Israel. And the primary issue in the Middle East, the most important one, is the Arab-Israeli conflict and finding a just solution for it. People in the Middle East are getting bored with the West lecturing to them without doing anything about this conflict.
Maher Otman of Al Hayat in London and Khalid El Mayin of Arab News in Saudi Arabia. The population of Bethlehem and its satellite town Bet Jala in the West Bank is a diverse mix of refugees and wealthy, long-established families, Muslims and Christians. All were under siege for 10 days when Israel reoccupied the area, vowing to stop Palestinians who were shooting at a nearby suburb of Jerusalem built on occupied land, that is Gilo. The Palestinian Authority says 22 locals were killed in the operation, 14 of them civilians. Barbara Plett went to a wealthy Christian neighbourhood to find out how a university professor and her teenage daughter had coped.
Haifa Nassar is in the kitchen preparing coffee and snacks. She's just come home from her first day at Bethlehem University since the siege. Haifa spent her time listening to traumatized students rather than teaching mathematics, something she did a lot with her 15-year-old daughter Rana during the 10-day occupation.
She's at this age, teenager, and it's hard to deal with them. And in this situation, it was more difficult for me. As a mother, I didn't know what to do. She was bored. She felt like she wants to die. Why should I live? Why should I study? They're going to kill us anyhow. So why should I plan anything? Why should I dream of anything?
It's also been Rana's first day back at school. She's recovered some of her youthful energy after seeing friends.
Hi, Rana. This is Mona.
Hi, Mona.
They killed one of the people who I know. And we used to play tennis, and he used to play tennis too. I got more afraid because I didn't thought that someone who I know might die.
Were you expecting this kind of action, the reoccupation of Bethlehem?
Not me. Couldn't you expect this? So what they are saying that they want to defend their people. So Bejala is on the front line, and so they want us to behave ourselves, maybe, and not to shoot them.
You know, it's funny. We are terrorists. We have nothing, and they're fighting us, shooting us, and we are the terrorists. It's just crazy.
Things happening in Israel, bombings. I feel sorry for the families, for mothers, for children. I really feel bad for them as human beings.
I don't feel sorry for them, because we should feel sorry for ourselves, not for them. They lost a child or two or three, but we lose hundreds of people.
Rana used to strongly disagree with Hamas and Islamic Jihad, the militant groups that carry out suicide bombings. She's changed her mind now.
I think that they are great, they are doing a good job. Israel killing us, and we shouldn't just be sitting here. You know, they think that they might die in any way. So why don't they die and kill a lot of the Israeli with them?
What sort of future do you think you as a young person can build here?
I guess that I can do nothing but studying so that I can help my country. We need to build our society. They are destroying us, and we should rebuild ourselves.
And that report from Bejala in the West Bank was by Barbara Plett. Every year, the World Bank brings out a Global Economic Prospects Report. This year, as you might expect, it is dominated by September the 11th and the impact on emerging markets. When the rich world suffers, the poor world suffers more. And the World Bank's gloomy figures and predictions back that up. Ian Golden is the World Bank's Director of Development Policy.
The events of September the 11th came on top of a already very difficult external environment. The world economy was slowing and things were getting tougher for developing countries. Now they've got even worse since September the 11th, and we estimate that as a result of September the 11th, maybe 10 million more people will be in poverty than would otherwise have been the case. Up to 40,000 additional children will die that need not have died. And overall, it's going to be extremely tough for poor people in poor countries to get through the next couple of years. The more medium-term outlook is positive, but this year we expect developing country growth to be about half of what it was last year, and that is very serious, of course.
This is a prediction, or do you have sort of hard figures and hard trends to put flesh on this?
These are forecasts for the current year and for future years. We can't do anything but predict the future.
Right. It is axiomatic, isn't it, that when the rich catch a cold, the poor get a disease?
Yes, I think that's absolutely right.
And my tortuous metaphor.
Not only do they get a disease, but they can't afford the medicines or the warm clothes that you need to overcome the disease. So when people in poor countries get thrown onto the streets through unemployment, of course they don't have unemployment benefit, they don't have social security, the health and education systems are much more thinly spread. And so overall, for a poor person, economic insecurity is a much, much more significant and life-threatening often problem than it is for rich people in richer countries.
And the cause and effect is really quite simple, is it? I mean, it's a matter of if the rich economies are declining, the poor get hurt disproportionately. Because of dependence.
That's right. They're highly dependent on exports to the rich countries. They're highly dependent on things like tourism, travel. So when Americans decide to reduce their trips to the Caribbean by as much as a half, as has happened after September 11th, that just impacts dramatically on all the Caribbean countries which are tourism dependent. And of course, the big impact we've also seen is through commodity prices. So the price of sugar, the price of coffee, the price of cotton, these are the central exports of many African and Latin American countries, have declined by more than 6% since September 11th.
It's proving the anti-globalization case, isn't it? Global capitalism is bad for you if you're poor.
On the contrary, I think what this shows is that we need a more integrated world. And indeed, one of the strong messages we'd like to give is that the Doha talks, which are coming up for a development round of the World Trade Organization in the coming weeks, need to be successfully concluded in the interests of the poor. It's only by providing the poor with access to capital, access to global markets, that you're going to get them out of their predicament. Insulating them from the rich countries, saying to them that you can't integrate would be the worst possible thing that you could be possibly say to them. It's to condemn them to poverty indefinitely.
And that was Ian Golden, World Bank's Director of Development Policy. It's time for the business news now, and with it is Rachel Walton. Rachel.
Well, in actual fact, one of the biggest, well, the biggest economy in the world has just had a dose of good news. According to today's figures, the economy there contracted only 0.4%. Now, that's less than half the 1% or so that was expected. Wall Street rallied on that news, but at Deutsche Bank in New York, Carrie Leahy says there's little chance that the figures will be this good next time round.
With the employment sector here in the States so weak and with layoffs mounting and showing little sign of slowing down, no one looks for these numbers to be repeated in the fourth quarter, and you're going to get a really bad down 2% or more.
Meanwhile, in France, telecom equipment maker Alcatel said it will cut 10,000 more jobs in Europe and lose $4.5 billion this year. The company has already shed 23,000 workers worldwide, which adds up to a reduction of 30% of its global workforce. And with an Anglo-Saxon flourish, shares in Alcatel rose strongly, up 6.82% to €16.77, and the CAC 40 closed 2.10% higher. Apparently, dealers are encouraged by the cash flow situation. And as if to underline the situation, the government announced today that unemployment in September rose to 9.1% from 9% in August. That's the fourth month in a row that the jobless number has climbed. On now to the markets. On Wall Street, the Dow has ended down 46 to at 9,075. That's a fall of 0.5%. The mainly high-tech Nasdaq index was up 0.14% at 1,690. Earlier, London rose 0.7% at 50.40. On the New York currency markets, the dollar is up 0.4 Japanese yen at 122.4.
Thank you, Rachel. That was Rachel Walton bringing you today's business news. The wreck of a Spanish ship, which sank about 500 years ago, has been found off the Caribbean coast of Panama near Nombre de Dios. Archaeologists believe it is one of four ships the explorer Christopher Columbus used on his last trip to the Americas. Carlos Fitzgerald is Director of Historical Patrimony at Panama's National Culture Institute. I asked him why he thought this was one of Columbus's ships.
Well, we believe that it's a ship of the early exploration era, about 500 years ago. We are not sure that it's Christopher Columbus's. However, there is plenty of indirect circumstantial evidence that indicates that it may be the Vizcaína, which was one of the caravels that accompanied Columbus on his fourth trip on October 1502.
How did you find it?
It was found by an explorer about 4 years ago. And then now that our institute, the National Institute of Culture, has a unit of underwater exploration, we are beginning to look at some of those wrecks. And one of the things that called to our attention was the type of weaponry that appeared on the wreck, which is on shallow water next to the coast of the old city of Nombre de Dios, which was founded by the Spanish in the early 16th century.
Now, as an archaeologist, I think you suspect you're probably quite excited by this, because where it is, does that mean it's in sand, and does that mean, therefore, it's going to be preserved?
Yes, it is in a sandy bottom, which is on shallow reefs next to the coast. We are very worried that it's now been, you know, removed by the currents, so we need to do a rescue work, and I take advantage of this opportunity to call upon the international scientific community to give us help and support to do this research, since we have little funding and resources. But we are very excited. It's a very interesting, even if it's not Columbus's, if it's an early exploration vessel, we are going to have a wealth of information concerning the processes of exploration of the New World.
And that was Carlos Fitzgerald, Director of Historical Patrimony at Panama's National Cultural Institute, on the wreck that may well be one of Columbus's last ships.
BBC World Service website is your gateway to the world.
Get the latest news as it unfolds, 24 hours a day, at www.bbc.co.uk/worldservice.
Search our library of more than a million news stories, all available at the click of a mouse.
Get the lowdown on the markets with the facts, the figures, and the big business stories by clicking on World Business.
And stay on the ball with all the latest sports news, just a keystroke away on our sports pages.
If you've got something to say, take part in our online forums.
Find out what other people across the globe are saying and make your voice heard on the issues you care about on our Talking Point and Regional Debate pages.
All this and more at www.bbc.co.uk/worldservice.
BBC World Service Online, your gateway to a world at your fingertips.
Coming up on NewsHour in the next 30 minutes, the American businessman who tried to save Abdul Haq, differences among American Muslims over the bombing, sports news, and the children's book about life in Afghanistan. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Brody. This is NewsHour. The latest world news now with John Ovenden.
On what's been described as a day of diplomatic or difficult diplomacy, the British Prime Minister Tony Blair has met the Syrian and Saudi Arabian leaders at the start of a tour of the Middle East. In Damascus, President Bashar al-Assad of Syria said he supported international action against terrorism, but the word terrorist should not be used to describe groups fighting against Israel for Palestinian rights. Violence has continued in the West Bank, where Israeli forces have killed six Palestinians, including a top Hamas commander in the town of Hebron. Reports say Jamil Jadala was hiding in a barn when it was hit by a single Israeli missile. The United States Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld is to travel to Russia and some of Afghanistan's Central Asian neighbors this weekend to discuss the progress of the campaign against Afghanistan. In the latest attacks, U.S. planes have carried out a heavy bombing raid on Taliban positions north of the Afghan capital Kabul. Afghanistan's Taliban Foreign Minister Wakil Ahmed Butawakil has dismissed reports of rifts in the Taliban. At a news conference in the Taliban stronghold of Kandahar, Mr. Mutawakil denied reports that he'd secretly visited Pakistan in an effort to open talks with the United States. The head of the United Nations Refugee Agency, Ruud Lubbers, says he's failed to persuade Iran to open its doors to Afghan refugees. After talks with the Iranian president, Mohammad Khatami, Mr. Lubbers said the two sides had agreed to disagree. A fourth person has died from anthrax in the United States. The victim, a 61-year-old woman, had been critically ill since Sunday with the most serious inhaled form of the disease. The source of her infection has so far remained a mystery. As new figures confirm that the American economy shrank in the third quarter of this year, the World Bank has warned that the world is slipping towards a recession. In the U.S., economic output fell 0.4%, the first decline for 8 years, although the fall was not as sharp as some economists had forecast. BBC World Service News.
You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Brody. This is NewsHour. Abdul Haq was an Afghan with a long record in combat. He was a key commander in the east of the country, fighting the Soviet invasion. He was an enemy of the Taliban. He lived in exile in the Gulf, but was active in trying to create an alternative to them. He maintained that if there was a political structure to defect to, many would desert the Taliban. Last week he was captured and killed on a mission inside Afghanistan. On the receiving end of frantic satellite phone calls for help in Abdul Haq's final hours was his friend James Ritchie. He is a rich American businessman with lifelong family ties to Afghanistan and a deep political involvement with it now. He talked to me about Abdul Haq, the CIA, and what he thinks the Americans are doing wrong. First, that night when Taliban forces had surrounded Abdul Haq.
We immediately contacted Bud McFarlane, who contacted Department of Defense, and they put me in contact with people in the agency who in turn contacted someone in the Defense Department, and they put a surveillance drone out over the area. We requested that they might be able to send a helicopter pickup because it just happened to be that the place that they were pinned down at was less than a half a mile from an old Russian helicopter landing spot. So we were hoping for some kind of a rescue attempt, which never came.
Why not, do you think?
I'm assuming that they just thought it too risky to put something like that into that kind of a situation where they weren't really sure what they were getting into. It's extremely rugged terrain.
Many assumed that Abdul Haq would have been there with at least the support of the Americans because he was trying to create defections from the Taliban, but that wasn't the case.
verbally, they said they supported him, but he got absolutely zero support from the Americans.
Why? Didn't they trust him?
Well, I know that Abdul-Haq was pretty much his own man. I think he had the same difficulty during the 80s. He didn't cooperate with the ISI, maybe like they would have liked him to. And he
that's
probably
Pakistani intelligence.
Yes, and I don't imagine they expected him to do that again. And it appears that in this situation, we're again partnershipping with the ISI like we did last time.
Now, how do you feel about all this? Because you are close to him. You are very involved in Afghan exile politics for reasons we'll go into in a minute. Do you feel he ought to have had American support, and official American support? And are you bitter that he didn't?
I personally believe that of all the leaders, Abdul-Haq was the most Western, had the most Western mind, had objectives that were the most humane, that he was very much a patriot, and I believe that had we supported him, he was the most likely to turn about change there that would have been in our best interest.
But the aims of Abdul-Haq, and he was a man who was qualified to pursue these aims because of his position in the east of the country as a Pashtun, because the following he had, was to topple the Taliban and get defections from them. Does the American establishment, does the CIA not have those aims?
They certainly have those aims. I think that the question that needs to be asked is, how do they want to do it? Are there ways that they want to do it that are popular for them and that they need to do for the American public, and are there ways that are not so popular? It would appear to me that when something like that happens, unfortunately, the Americans were looking for some action. They want to see their president or their military take some kind of positive action. And to do something in more of an indigenous way, I think, is not going to meet with the approval of the public as much as maybe a more aggressive response would.
You mean they don't want to do it the quiet way?
It would appear to me that way, because there's no question that the quiet way is much more effective. In fact, I'm afraid that the strategy that we're using is so counterproductive. It's increasing support to the Taliban daily. It's rallying people from around the world to join this movement. It's taking the moderates that normally would have been our side and pushing them onto the other side of the fence. And at the same time, it's killing innocent Afghan people. It's propagandizing for the Taliban and for the Arabs in a way that they never could have done themselves. And I feel that the infrastructure that we're demolishing there is quite insignificant. You know, in terms of American air defense, I understand how that you erase some of their air defense systems, but certainly from the perspective of the Afghan resistance, the things that you're taking out are very insignificant compared to what you're giving the Taliban in return.
Tell me just a little bit about yourself. Why are you involved here? I know as a child you lived in Kabul. Your father was involved with an engineering project there. Why your intense involvement now?
Well, it's just kind of something that's developed. I've been interested in Afghanistan all my life and been involved in a number of different businesses, humanitarian things there. And finally, I got involved in the political process because it seemed to me that until they came up with some kind of a stable political situation, there's really nothing that you can do there that has any kind of permanence or any kind of stability, and that's by far the most important thing, I think, to the Afghan people right now.
And that was American businessman James Ritchie. People in the Afghan capital, Kabul, have repeatedly said that they fear that the American campaign might lead to a return to chaos in their city. And after 1992, when the communist government of Najibullah fell to the Mujahideen, they suffered 4 years of lawlessness and fighting. Our displaced Kabul correspondent Kate Clark, who is in Shamali, north of Kabul, looks at the prospects for the Afghan capital should the Taliban fall.
The period when the parties of the Northern Alliance were last in power
1992 to 1996, is remembered with great bitterness in Kabul. 50,000 civilians were killed in 4 years of internecine fighting, started by the Pakistan-backed commander Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, and then carried on by all the factions. I've come to visit one man who lived through those times, Dr. Mehriban, who now has a small clinic just off the bazaar in a town on the Northern Alliance side of the front line.
Two of my uncles and 8 cousins were killed. 2 nephews were injured, along with 2 of my brothers. There was no safe place in Kabul at that time.
What practical steps do you think could be taken in Kabul city in order to make sure that there's order if the Taliban fall?
First of all, they have to make sure Pakistan doesn't interfere again. But then, if other foreigners come, they should bring an international force in a special uniform to control Kabul, Swedish or Danish or Turkish. They should take some of the experienced people from here. Without their help, they won't be able to enter or control Kabul. Then the former king should come, and I guarantee that all Afghans from every group will gather around him. The residents of Kabul are tired of armed men.
There are people looking for alternatives to years of rule by armed men from any ethnic group. A political agreement and some sort of security arrangement, both will be necessary if Kabul and other cities are not to fall headlong into chaos, if the Taliban fall.
And that was Kate Clark reporting from Shamali, north of Kabul. So when or if the Taliban regime falls, what does come next? The UN is currently grappling with this. One comparison being made is with Cambodia. That was the largest UN operation in history. And like Afghanistan, Cambodia was just about destroyed. Simon Chesterman is Director for Transitional Administration Projects with the International Peace Academy, which advises the UN Secretary-General, Kofi Annan.
Well, I think the first thing to establish is that the difference between any prospective operation in Afghanistan and what's been happening in East Timor and Kosovo. And one of the concerns within the UN, as I understand it, is that expectations are being raised to the point where people think that the UN can go in and rebuild a country like Afghanistan. That's simply not possible. Cambodia presents a better analogy because the UN didn't really assert primary governmental responsibility over the entirety of the country. Rather, it was delegated certain responsibilities from a Supreme National Council that was formed by a treaty arrangement between various parties, fulfilled its functions, and then left. Now, indeed, some people would argue that even that is far too ambitious for Afghanistan, because in Cambodia you had a very significant peacekeeping presence that seems, well, at best, a difficult task to mount in Afghanistan.
There are parallels with Cambodia, aren't there? I mean, some say unkindly that the comparison with Cambodia tells you just how low expectations are.
Exactly, and one of the concerns is that the Cambodian operation is often regarded as a successful operation because the UN went in within the time period, had an election and then left, and then the country was hardly a success story afterwards. There was a coup, there's been substantial instability. Cambodia now is on the road to some sort of improvement. That's more due to the actions of the Cambodians themselves rather than the international presence.
But you accept the comparison?
Well, I think for want of alternatives, the problem here is that the UN is, and the concern among many of us here who are friends of the UN, is that for want of alternatives, the United States and Great Britain are going to hand some sort of poison chalice to the UN, that when they withdraw or when they complete their operations, they will be expecting the UN to go and pick up the pieces of Afghanistan, and then if or when Afghanistan falls apart once again and dissolves into civil war, it will be the UN's fault rather than those countries that are currently engaging in military adventures there.
Can I just pursue the analogy for a moment? Zahir Shah presumably plays a Sihanouk role. The Taliban are the Khmer Rouge. Who's Hun Sen, the prime minister who led the country?
Well, this is the one unfortunate thing, that perhaps Hun Sen was Massoud, who was killed a couple of days before the World Trade Center went down. And that indeed appears to have been part of the plan of bin Laden, assuming, and we haven't yet been given public information proving all this, but assuming that he was behind the World Trade Center bombing, it seems quite likely that he and his forces were responsible for removing one of the key allies on the ground that would currently be part of the operation to overthrow him and his Taliban hosts.
Simon Chesterman, Director for Transitional Administration Projects with the International Peace Academy. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. A group of American Muslim organizations has called for the United States to halt its bombing campaign in Afghanistan and instead develop a more effective and long-term policy. 15 groups signed the document, among them two prominent organizations. Several other American Muslim groups, though, did not sign. To inquire into this difference of opinion among American Muslims, I spoke to Ali Abuzakouk of the American Muslim Council, non-signers of the document, and Naeem Beg of the Islamic Circle of North America, a signer of the document, who explained why they opposed the bombing.
Initially, when we issued our statement after the bombing in Afghanistan, we stood behind our government in getting after the terrorists. But after a couple of weeks of bombing, we felt that this bombing is not going anywhere and the terrorists are nowhere to be found. When Mr. Rumsfeld gave a statement that Osama bin Laden may get away or we may not get Osama bin Laden, it made us worried that our government do not know where these people are and does not have a clear-cut strategy.
And in the meantime, you think that the bombing campaign is positively doing damage?
Yes, certainly. As each day is passing by, a number of casualties is increasing. And not only that, but a lot of Afghans are now out of their homes, and the winter is approaching fast. So is the month of Ramadan, and they're out in the open, and they're in a horrible condition.
Mr. Abuzakouk, your organization decided not to sign this document. Where do you differ? Where do you take issue with what you've just heard from Mr. Beg?
First of all, let me tell you that our basic position is that we supported our campaign against the terrorists, and it is not a campaign against the Afghani people. And the campaign has done some successes in undermining the infrastructure of the Taliban and the Qaeda organization, but has not completed its objectives, goals yet, and leave that to the military people. The question is that the campaign and the bombing has always been concerted against the military objectives and the military installations and the organizational structure of the terrorist organization. It has never been directed to the Afghan people or the civilians. It is true that some civilians have been shown to be, suffering casualties. Unfortunately, we pray for them and we are not for that. But at the same time, we cannot just say, stop the bombing now, while the objectives of the campaign has not yet been achieved.
But you accept Mr. Begg's point that the objectives have not been achieved. There's no sign of Osama bin Laden and no sign that these objectives will be achieved.
No, the objectives are still underway. It's not just a war against Osama bin Laden. It's a war against the terrorist organization, which is headed by Osama bin Laden, and the government that harbors them. They are still there. As long as they are there, I don't think the objectives has been achieved. And it is really important for us to stand behind our government in this issue, even though we may also caution them that we have to be more careful.
Mr. Beg, as a Muslim organization, do you not feel that there is perhaps a danger that you should be seen not to be standing behind the American government on this?
Yes, we understood that, and when we made the statement, we thought about it, that in present circumstances it may be considered unpatriotic, but we feel that it's our responsibility as American citizens to point out the dangers that our country faces. Just before President Bush, our President, Mr. Clinton, did oppose our war in Vietnam, but later on he was elected as the president of the country. So this country is for freedom of speech and freedom of opinion.
But your point is that you fear that this campaign is actually in danger of damaging the United States.
Exactly.
Mr. Abuzakouk, what do you say to that?
We're not just for war by itself, but we said that the campaign has to continue until the terrorists are really either caught, brought to justice, or justice brought to them.
Ali Abu Zakouk of the American Muslim Council and Naeem Beg of the Islamic Circle of North America. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Brody. This is NewsHour. Our main headline, Arab sensitivities about the bombing of Afghanistan and the plight of the Palestinians have been spelt out to the British Prime Minister Tony Blair on the first full day of his Middle East tour. It's time for the sports news now. Let's go to the sports newsroom and Rory McDonald. Rory.
Thanks, Alex. First to football, and that Porto have booked the final spot in phase two of this season's Champions League. With all the full-time results, here's Ed Harry.
Yes, Jesus Pena, the hero for the Portuguese club. They were 1-0 winners at home to Rosenborg. Pena's goal coming in the 36th minute. It means that Porto take the last Champions League slot on offer. They finished second in the group behind Juventus, who themselves lost 4-3 away at Celtic. That victory for Celtic in a 7-goal thriller wasn't enough to take them through to the next phase of the Champions League, but they do have the consolation of a UEFA Cup place. In Group F, Barcelona finished top. They were 1-0 winners at home to Fenerbahce. Bayer Leverkusen finished second despite losing 4-2 at home to Olympique Lyon, who go into the UEFA Cup. In Group G, Manchester United finished second behind Deportivo La Coruña, and Lille are the UEFA Cup team there. Lille won, Manchester United won, Olympiacos won, La Coruña won tonight. Finally, Group H, Feyenoord 2, Spartak Moscow 1, Sparta Prague 0, Bayern Munich won. Bayern finished first, second place for Sparta Prague, Feyenoord in the UEFA Cup.
Thanks, Ed. Tens of thousands of Iranians have poured onto the street of Tehran to celebrate their 3-0 World Cup playoff win over the United Arab Emirates. All the major thoroughfares of the capital were clogged with horn-blowing motorists, their cars draped with Iranian flags. Iran's victory sets up a showdown with the Republic of Ireland, with the winner going through to next year's finals. In cricket, Pakistan has inflicted Zimbabwe with their 16th consecutive one-day defeat in their Champions Trophy match in Sharjah. Zimbabwe, chasing 262 runs to win, were on target, thanks to a third wicket stand of 159 between Grant and Andy Flower. But a lively burst of bowling from Wasim Akram and Waqar Yunus saw Zimbabwe lose their last 8 wickets for 73 and the match by 29 runs. Sri Lanka and Pakistan meet in Sunday's final. And in tennis, Tim Henman and Roger Federer's chances of making the prestigious season-ending Masters Cup in Sydney suffered setbacks today. Both were beaten in the second round action at the Masters Series event in Paris. And Alex, that's all the sport.
Thank you, Rory McDonald. Now, when it comes to warfare, we are repeatedly told that we are in the television age. But with this war in Afghanistan, we see very little. The Arabic television channel Al Jazeera is there. The three main news agencies do have Afghan correspondents, but the rest of the international media are excluded. Yesterday, though, the Taliban relaxed their prohibition and escorted into Kandahar a group of the foreign press. Among them, our correspondent Simon Ingram. I asked him what he's been seeing.
I think there's no doubt at all, Alex, that there has been a great deal of damage done to Kandahar over the past few weeks. The bombing has been going on almost nightly in and around the city. The main sites, the main targets have, of course, been military ones, which were not the ones that we were taken to. The purpose of this visit, of course, the reason why the Taliban had brought us in, is to show us the terrible things, the terrible damage that has been done to civilian lives and property. So it was with that in mind that they took us to half a dozen sites in all, in various parts of the city, ranging from some shops in the city centre, which had got flattened by a missile or a bomb, and not clear what. They also took us to a clinic, to a large building on the outskirts of the town, which was flattened in the early hours of Wednesday morning.
The Taliban line being put out is that some 1,500 civilian casualties have been caused by the American bombing. From what you have seen, they're finding it difficult to produce the evidence to support that.
I think that has to be the conclusion. It is, of course, an impossible figure to verify, and they must realize that. But if, given the difficulty with which they've been able to stand up the casualties that were sustained, even in a random series of incidents down here in Kandahar before the eyes of the international media, I think that one must raise a certain amount of doubt about just how far these figures have been enlarged in order to make a greater impact in international opinion.
Now, Kandahar is supposed to be the Taliban stronghold. Have you seen any of the leadership?
In point of fact, this evening, more or less out of the blue, the foreign minister, Mr. Mutawakil, turned up, and he was asked, for example, about this claim that a number of American soldiers had been captured recently. And he said, well, he hadn't heard anything about that, he didn't really know anything about it, but at the same time, he wouldn't deny it. Again, leaving many questions just hanging in the air. But the overall impression one got from him was of the amazing confidence that these people have.
Simon Ingram in Kandahar. Now, the story of a children's book which explains life under the Taliban. It is written by a Canadian author, Deborah Ellis, and was published in North America well before this war in Afghanistan. It is now being rushed into print in Britain by Oxford University Press, who say bookshops have had many inquiries from parents seeking something to help them explain to their children what is going on. It is The Breadwinner, the story of a girl who pretends to be a boy so she can work to help feed her mother and sisters who must stay inside. Here's a taste of it.
She wasn't really supposed to be outside at all. The Taliban had ordered all the girls and women in Afghanistan to stay inside their homes. They even forbade girls to go to school. As a small girl, she could usually get away with being outside without being questioned. "I need this girl to help me walk," her father would tell any Talib who asked, pointing to his leg. He had lost the lower part of his leg when the high school he was teaching in was bombed. Parvana would slump down further on the blanket and try to make herself look smaller. She was afraid to look up at the soldiers. She had seen what they did, especially to women, the way they would whip and beat someone they thought should be punished. Sitting in the marketplace, day after day, she had seen a lot. When the Taliban were around, what she wanted most of all was to be invisible.
That excerpt from The Breadwinner was read for us by Micheline McGrath. The book's author is Deborah Ellis. I asked her what provoked her to write such a book for children.
Well, I was in Pakistan in the refugee camps interviewing women for an adult book called Women of the Afghan War, which is a collection of oral histories about women's lives in the 20 years of war in Afghanistan. And I met a woman whose mother does what Parvana does in the book. She, the child that the mother I met, she cut off her hair and she put on boys' clothing in order to work in the streets of Kabul to earn money for the family. And as soon as I heard that story, I knew that I'd write it as a children's novel.
Did you meet Parvana?
No, just the mother.
So Parvana is from your imagination?
Yes, based on what's really going on there.
How did the book do in Canada and in the States?
Well, it did very well even before this latest round of difficulties for the Afghan people. And, of course, now there are a lot more inquiries about it in North America than there were before.
But even before this happened and before the Afghan situation was brought to the notice of the North American public, it was selling?
Quite well, actually.
Do you think it was selling because it is per se? A good children's book, or because of the topic?
Well, I think it's kind of both. At least I hope it's a good book. Brave, but she acts in a very brave way to an extraordinarily horrible situation, and I think that touches people when they hear about that.
It sounds fairly horrific to me.
Well, the whole thing is very horrific, and when I wrote it for children, I had to make it come out a lot happier than it does in most cases.
We are sometimes in the news business accused of overkill and accused of basically turning people off because we bludgeon them with news and information. Fiction gets to a different part of the brain, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a way that we can get into the reality of something in a way that will perhaps touch us a little bit more personally than a news story will, for example.
And that was Deborah Ellis, author of The Breadwinner. And with that, we come to an end of this edition of NewsHour. From me, Alex Brody, from the rest of the team here at Bush House, thank you for listening. Goodbye.